55. Open hearing on SB 5509, the Department of Education. Ms. Fleming, you have a few parties to introduce, and as always, I have a quorum on the House side, but I have no quorum on the Senate side. So.
Good morning. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Vicki Fleming, Deputy Superintendent, Department of Education. This morning on the schedule, we have a presentation by Dr. Nancy Latini, who's the Assistant Superintendent for the Office of Student Learning and Partnerships. And if you recall in our original overview, this office is the one who does a broad variety of things and delivers most of the manages most of the contracts that deliver direct services to a lot of special needs populations in Oregon. And lots of challenges that Nancy has with the work that she does, including the Schools for the Deaf and the Blind. And I think our time today in the two-hour period that we have is to get through Nancy's presentation, go ahead and talk about system accountability and policy development, and then, as the chair requested, leave time for invited testimony at the end. So with that, I'll turn it over to Nancy.
Good morning. I'm Nancy Latini, Office of Student Learning and Partnerships. This office spends most of its time looking at providing direct service and monitoring services to students that have diverse learning, whether it's involved with instructional needs, social-emotional needs, socio-economic needs, language or ethnicity or whatever. What we do is we embed our work within ensuring students have access to pre-K through secondary general education curriculum. We're assuring that accommodations and support services are available to students who have unique learning needs, and we're involved with implementing, managing, and monitoring programs that are reflected in state and federal laws. The office has a lot of units in it, and you can see those in the organization chart of your notebook. What I'm going to do today, rather than going through each of the units, is to group them into four areas and talk about the work and how it affects the district, and so that you can see what we're doing. You should have probably three supplemental pieces of information, two that are contained in your notebook already, one that is stapled together and has a finance task force set of materials, if you have your notebook with you. The other one is has to do with pre-kindergarten systems. And then this morning I handed out one other one that I thought was some information that probably would be more interesting to you after listening for the last few weeks. And this is the one with the cover sheet on it. I'm going to start off with the Office of Special Education and information for you there. This is clearly the largest and most litigated section of our office. And I'm going to talk a little bit to you today about the finance part of special education, accountability, demographics, and the reauthorization of the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, IDEA.
Excuse me. Yeah. Could we just make sure we're all on the same page?
Okay.
So where are you? Are you in the binder or in handouts?
Right now, I'm just talking to you, and I'm going to refer to two sets of handouts.
Okay.
I'm going to refer to a few things in here.
One.
And if you have your notebook, there'll be a few things in a section that says financing of special education on the top of it.
Do you know where it is in the
book? I think they were at the end of the notebook. Brad is looking. I never got my
special notebook. Report.
If I could just clarify, Nancy, is that the white notebook, the governor's recommended budget, or the black one?
It's the notebook that talks the black one.
Okay. Let's close those white ones.
No. Please proceed.
Thank you. Essentially, special education at the state level is charged by the federal government to assess the effectiveness and the impact of appropriate public education on students birth to 21 who have learning some kinds of disabilities. Consequently, there are several accountability systems in our office, one regarding performance review and improvement, another one on legal review, and one on fiscal review. One of the very different things about IDEA compared to No Child Left Behind Act is that They both focus on accountability, and we have no doubt that looking at accountability in students with disabilities, we are seeing some improvement in performance. The difference, however, is in the concepts. When you look at No Child Left Behind, we're talking about attending to school district and school outcomes. When we look at IDEA, we really focus on the individual student, and we look at individual processes for those students. Another example is with the two laws that have really big differences is the time frames. No Child Left Behind focuses on the big picture, annual progress. If this happens the first year, this might happen to you. If you don't make annual progress, this happens the second year. Within the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, we need to look at things like calendar days versus school days. We need to look at the difference between direct services versus related services, placement considerations. So it's a lot more of a detailed look, and what we're trying to do now is balance the two, since some of the new law, which I'll talk about later, does align with No Child Left Behind. I'm going to talk a little bit about the finance part of our office first. We have a task force on special education finance and accountability that was formed by the legislature two sessions ago, and we continue to meet on financial issues related to special education. In your black notebook, you have this one-page summary that'll sort of give you the purpose of what that finance committee is all about and the types of people that are on it. There are school people, there are legislators, and there are representatives from other entities that are involved in or affected by special education finance. This is the group that made the recommendation on the high-cost disability group to raise the bar from $25,000 to $30,000. It's also the same group that wanted to make sure and put amendments into the act that would say that the districts had to spend all their weighted funds before they could even apply for these funds. I think we thought it was assumed in the law in what we wrote, but as the committee looked at it, they felt they wanted to make it very clear, and so that was another thing that they've done. So they've looked at a lot of the pieces as they relate to finance and special education. The maintenance of effort is a challenge at the state level that, again, the committee has looked at and that we have looked at for quite a while relative to how the state calculates our maintenance of effort. You have, again, and I think it's the last page of that, last two pages of that same document that I just talked about that had finance on the front. I don't know how these got together, but the last page, two pages, describes maintenance of effort at the state and district level. You have a feel for what that means. Essentially, what maintenance of effort means is that we have to spend the same amount of money in general funds as we did the previous year, and we have calculations to do that on. The department, or the Office of Special Education, for a year or two, calculated that on just the money that was spent to operate the office. It was made clear by the federal government that what we had to do was take a look at programs and any of the general fund money that went to special education. And so the year I came on was the first year that we tried to calculate that using all the programs. And you'll see the programs that are included that have general funds is the early childhood special education programs, the state school for the deaf, the state school for the blind, our corrections programs, hospital long-term care and treatment, and our regional programs. They all have general funds. They all had to be calculated in that maintenance of effort formula. We were very worried at the time that we might not make maintenance of effort, and what happens if we don't is the federal government withholds our funds to the degree we don't make it. And who really hurts on that is not the state but the districts, because our funds flow right to the district. So the emergency board held aside some money in case we didn't make it to help us with it. We had a lot of conversations with the federal government because we have a biennial budget. And so we tried to say, couldn't we take both years and balance it out and calculate it that way? And, of course, the initial response was, no, you have to do it annually. So we looked at all the states that had biennial budgets or met biennially. What happens in all the other states but Oregon is they still get an annual budget, so they can calculate year by year. And we made a case to say we don't do that, and so we still should be able to balance the 2 years out. And they did give us permission to do that. So with that calculation, we were able to make maintenance of effort, and we did not use the money that was set aside for us at the e-board. And we're hoping that we can continue to do that same thing. In your same notebook, in that same packet, you have several charts, and I won't talk about them now, and if you have questions later, we can, but several charts around child count and the numbers of kids and the disabilities related to special education and how we look in Oregon right now as of December 1 of this school year. We'll talk a little bit more about that later. Essentially, we have 79,203 students ages birth to 21 years of age that are identified in Oregon as having a disability. The placements vary from being in the general education classroom, which about 90% of our students are in the general ed classroom, to kids who are in residential treatment facilities. And the districts are responsible for all of those kids.
Senator Devlin, I want to make sure that you actually have found the handouts that Nancy's referring to.
Those that have their black notebooks, I think, have found them.
Well, there's a question there. What is the heading at the top?
The heading at the top of this one says Office of Special Education Task Force. It's sort of like a memo.
Okay.
And it's not in your black notebook.
Well, it may be, but our black notebook is a little thick. You know.
Yeah, okay, I'm sorry about that.
The black notebook doesn't have many subdivisions in it, so it's kind of difficult.
Should have looked at one of the subdivisions.
Senator Devlin, we'll go get extra copies of this to make sure that you end up with two copies. I appreciated Representative Benson's suggestion that perhaps we should have laptops and electronic files in front of us as opposed to these gigantic notebooks that no one could carry. We'll work on that.
It'd even be helpful if they were so that you could push the buttons down there so that the right stuff will appear here. I mean,
turn the pages for you.
That's what would be legislature friendly.
Let me go to the handout I know you have.
There you go.
The one I personally brought this morning for you.
Please proceed.
And let's take a look at, two pages. One of these to have it, please. Actually, go to the back. So in three pages, and you'll see a title, a half sheet that says Special Education Federal Dollars and Distribution.
Yes.
Okay. These are the funds, just again for your information, the funds that come into the state of Oregon and where they go. The total is $113 million. A little over 90% flows right out to the school districts on a formula that includes our child count and a couple of other pieces. It's a convoluted formula. If you want to know about it, we certainly can have somebody else talk to you about it. But that 90.48 goes directly out to the school districts. Then we have capacity building funds that are required for us to hold aside, and we keep 9/10 of it at this point. And what that money is for special projects in districts or that go district or statewide. An example right now is we're involved in some model demonstration programs for students with autism, and we're developing classes across the state, classrooms for children with autism at the from preschool through high school that we're contracting with Portland State University to do some specific training. This year we've opened 20 classes across the district, the state, and hopefully by the end of this process, which is a three-year process, we'll have about 60 classes. So it won't matter where a parent lives in Oregon. If they have a child with autism, they don't have to move to the metro area. They don't have to send their child far away, but they'll have classes that are well-trained, well-constructed classrooms any place that they live in. So that's what we're hoping to do. So that's where some of the fund goes. We had some funds last year to develop a manual on crisis management for kids that the behaviors are outside the norm of behavior, and we might have to call the police in, or we might have to do something different. We're in the process right now of training all the community and school districts around some ways of looking at those protocols. So the money is kind of directed towards special needs that we see in Oregon. And then we set aside the money that is for the primary charge of us, and that is the monitoring and legal aspect, and then the administration money. If you go back one page. Yes, I'm sorry.
On legal, what are the expenses related to legal? I'll preface this in that my district or one of my districts, there seems to be a lot of money spent legally fighting parents on IDEA and things like that. How's this legal spent here?
We have a team, and we call it the dispute resolution team, and what they try to do is help school districts make resolve issues with parents before it gets to something like a litigated due process hearing. So what we have are some options around dispute resolution with mediation, and we pay for mediators to go out to districts and help them resolve issues, and we pay for the mediator regardless of the outcome. School districts or parents can ask for a mediator, and there are times when we see that possibly there's such an issue going on, we'll suggest that maybe they have a mediator come in. And so that's one of the steps that we use, and it's being used more and more. You know, mediation sort of asks you to change your behaviors, and sometimes that's very difficult to do. And so initially when we first started doing this, we would get 5 or 10 requests a year, and now we're getting maybe like 20, 25, or 30, and that to us is a really good sign of trying to resolve issues ahead of time. We also have complaints that parents, if mediation doesn't work or they're not interested, parents have a right to file a formal complaint, and we have complaint investigators that we pay for that'll go out and interview the school people, the parents, look at the files, and come up with some kind of a decision on that. And then we have the formal due process hearings that Oregon has very few. We're in the single digits, and we're one of very few states that have remained in the single digits for due process hearings. Many of our issues are resolved prior to that.
What's sort of the balance of this $7.8 million in monitoring versus legal? Do you know?
More would be in the monitoring, but much more, and I'll tell you a little bit about that.
Thank you.
If you go back one page, you can see the selected district. I chose the same district to use that you talked about last week. And you'll see where the federal and special education funds, the school funds, the IDEA money. They get $4 million out of that money. I didn't put the general fund money down that the school district gets, but I looked at what they got as the 11% waiver cap. And so the additional money that they would get is right there for you, $560,000. And the same is true for the high-cost disability when they submitted their request for funds. This is the additional money out of the general funds that they got for that, for the numbers of kids in high-cost disabilities. This district also met maintenance of effort for 0102. All districts have to also meet maintenance of effort in a little different way, and they're close to meeting it for 0203. We're still working on it with them at this point. As I said earlier, accountability is specified in the federal law as the primary responsibility of the state. In other words, our charge is to assure that the procedural efforts that are going on in schools are in compliance with the law. One of the major accountability areas we just talked about has to do with looking at and resolving issues in a timely manner around legal issues. I shared a little bit of that with you at this point in what we offer with mediation. The selected district that we that we talked about last week and talking about this week, Ben Lapine, had 3 mediation requests this past year. One was resolved locally before mediation, one was settled in mediation, and one still isn't settled. They're still working on it. We also had 3 requests for due process hearings in this district. 2 were resolved before a hearing was even scheduled, and 1 went to a hearing and is now on appeal by the parent. And we had 1 complaint that was filed, and it was dismissed before we had it scheduled, so people worked it out. And those are all good signs. We always want them to be able to resolve those issues at the local level. We also have a huge monitoring process that again, is our major focus. In the early years, monitoring included state-level people coming into a school district and meeting with the special ed director and maybe the superintendent, and they would have two lists. And one list had a list of materials and documents that we had to show them we had. Another list was a list of students, and those are the files that they looked at, and they made sure that all the blanks were filled in, all the dates were right, and kind of the stuff of crossing the T's and dotting the I's had nothing to do with what student outcomes and student processes were. We now have a new system for monitoring, and we call it the System of Systems Improvement, Performance Review and Improvement, and that also is in the handout you don't have, and so when you get it, we'll show you a little summary. But what it essentially is all the data that we have on school districts related to special education, student performance, dropout data, graduation data, discipline data, any of their performance reviews. We also have a parent survey, and the parent results of the parent survey are given back to the districts on a secure website. They can not only look at their own data, but they can also look at districts that are the like size of them or like geographic area. And what they do with this is take a look at where they might have triggers to set improvement plans. Our job then is to go out and help them develop that improvement plan and to look at where they might need to look at things. They also review their own files. We found that they are much tougher on themselves when they look at files for compliance review than the state is. And we have to go in sometimes and say, you really don't need to cite yourself on this. This really isn't violating somebody's right. But they're often very, very tight on themselves, hard on themselves with that. What we have found in this new system is we've heard from superintendents saying that it's a much friendlier system. They feel they own the system much more than they did in the past, and they feel more of a part of it. We also got an email the other day, and I'm just going to read you the first paragraph of it. This is from South Lane School District, and they had just gone through their first phase of this process, and they said, it's not often that one anticipates an experience with some anxiety, like going to the dentist, and then comes out the other end wanting to repeat the process again, and then goes on to talk about how much they learned. And this is really what we want. We don't want to slap districts' hands for doing something that is a small thing in a complex process of special education. We want to help them own the project and to improve whatever they're doing at this point. These districts also get small grants, and again, you'll see that on the selected district funds. They get a phase one when they look at their data. They get some funding so that they can pull teachers out and use substitutes and look at their data, and they'll get a small grant to start implementing their improvement plan as well. The results of these plans then go into a database at the department, and what we do is we look at what needs the districts have, and we start planning our own work plan. Again, in the document I gave you, you'll see there's something called a presentation description worksheet. This is the worksheet, right. What we have is we have an electronic evaluation of any kinds of trainings that we do. When we go out to a district or we send somebody else out or we contract with people, we ask the participants to complete an evaluation. We are able then to put that back into an electronic system and able to take a look at, are we responding to what districts actually ask us to do, or if we send somebody else out, are we responding in a positive way, or what is it that we need to do to change what we're doing? And so it helps us to formulate our work and to be responsive to districts.
I just want to interject, Mr. Chair, and now that Senator Nelson is back, that this is one of the ways that we are seeking to be more efficient, to use this sort of electronically deployed devices, which really allow us to take the information, roll it up, and inform ourselves about where we need to be paying attention. And I think it's an example of a process that we're attempting to use with our continuous improvement planning for all districts so that they can interact with the software and get information and act on that in a better way as well. To add that plug-in.
One of the nicest things about the electronic system for the schools is that when they go on to the website, they also have some voice overlay so they can say, here's your data. Is there a trigger? You might want to look at this. You might want to look at this. So we're thinking about the least stable and the most stable types of school districts that we can trigger some kinds of thinking for people that they'll go further. And so it's vocal, and they don't have to just sort of make up their own, what am I looking for here? And so it's a friendly system that we seem to like at this point. One last thing on reauthorization. And I'll just talk about this for a minute. The President Bush signed into law in December of 2004 the reauthorization of the Federal Special Ed Act, and we're now moving toward trying to figure out what it says. And the rules we expect to come out in December, they'll be having hearings over the summer. We just went to and revised all the Oregon statutes so that they did align to the new law, and we have to do that quickly and do it now while you're here, because we couldn't wait for 2 years and have you come back to pass to look at those statutes. So we've done that piece of it. We won't do anything with rules until the rules are in place from the federal government. Some of the things that you might be interested in the new law that I'm just going to touch on is, for the first time, districts will be allowed to use 15% of their IDEA funds for early intervening services. That doesn't mean early intervention and early childhood. What it means is any pre-referral, any information that kinds of instruction that they do to maintain a student outside, keep them out of special education. The discipline process is... The discipline process is also more closely aligned with the general ed discipline process. That's always been a question of how we treated our students differently. IEP meetings now can be held not necessarily face-to-face, but they can do it electronically. And there are certain circumstances where even the required members of an IEP team don't have to be face-to-face in a meeting. So they're loosening up some things that are going to maybe make it a little easier for school districts around paperwork and all. There are two options that they've offered up to states if they're interested in them, and one is called the Paperwork Reduction Pilot. That sounded very interesting, to me it did. But when I started to look at it, I learned that we would probably end up, the district, having more paperwork than less paperwork if we were into the pilot, because there were a lot of reports they would have to fill out. And the thing that bothered me the most about it was they were tying student growth to the reduction in paper. And I have a hard time thinking that student is going to progress more because we're not sending one notice to a parent. And that it just didn't... I think there would be more stress on districts if we went into the pilot than if we just waited and learned from the mistakes of others. And the other piece that they're looking at is having a more seamless system for early childhood from birth to five. Right now they're pretty two separate programs, except in Oregon we have kept a seamless system. So we've talked to our stakeholders and our advisory groups, and we decided that if we went to that pilot, we'd confuse parents more than if we stayed with the seamless system we already have. So if you hear about those two, that's where we are with them at this point. Are there any questions about special education at this point?
Yes. Just a couple. One, not in the materials that we have before us, but in the annual report part that actually lists a number of the categories or demographics in special ed, it shows some significant increases in certain categories. Has there been any evaluation saying, well, in some way indicating why there have been such vast increases in some areas of special ed?
My guess is one of them, Chair Devlin, would be the autism, numbers
yes.
of students with autism.
The brain injury is another one.
That's right, exactly. I'll start with autism. Autism is probably one of the easier ones. All of those students probably would still be in special education, but they might be called mentally retarded, speech and language impaired, learning disabled, emotionally disturbed. What's happened in the past, since the 70s, is we've learned a great deal more about students with autism and what it entails, and we're much better at identifying what they are and who they are. And very special techniques and training that goes on with these students aren't the usual typical experiences that you can use with other students. So the numbers have increased. The numbers were low to start with, and they've increased a great deal. But these students, as I said, would probably, and no doubt, still require specially designed instruction on an IEP, but we believe they're more accurately reflected. This is true nationwide. This is not just true in Oregon, but and there has been lots and lots of, and you probably know about the lots of different ways that people have tried to identify what the cause is, and there's maybe 10, 20, 15 different causes, but all we know is that we can identify them closer to what's needed for them. Many of these students are in general education classrooms with techniques that are specially designed for them, and many of them are in separate classes. Traumatic brain injury, guess that the best thing to say there is that we're more medically technology able to save students who have traumatic brain injuries, you know, head car accidents, any assault on the brain after birth is what that would entail. And oftentimes, again, these students would be in the hospital for a short period of time, leave, and not get any services. We're much better at the hospitals understanding what part of the brain is assaulted, how that might affect a student, and be able to share that information with schools so that we can properly look at those things. They're very challenging in some cases.
Other follow-up questions? When IDEA was being considered for reauthorization, not really considered because it was going to be reauthorized, at one time the federal government was in relatively good fiscal position, and there were indications that the federal government would far more adequately fund IDEA. Of course, federal government's fiscal position changed substantially. What are we looking at in terms of funding at the federal level? Is it staying at its historical high of 18%? Or
I think Chair Devlin, you're absolutely right. It's staying at its historical high of 18%.
Oh. So just 22% short of the original federal promise. Okay. Any additional questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would like to ask about the IEP process that occurs without the face-to-face contact that you described. Is there a concern about there's so much that happens in a face-to-face meeting? There's the relationship building. There's the interaction that just comes through, verbal communication and the nuances of communication. It just seems that something would be lost in a process that isn't face-to-face. Are there concerns about the quality of the IEP development and planning, the quality and comprehensiveness in this other approach?
Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley, I certainly understand your questions. First of all, it would only be done with the parent approval.
Mm-hmm.
Oftentimes, it might be a parent who can't get there and would rather do it by telephone. What I would see probably the most beneficial are for students and parents who have been in the system a while and maybe in a remote area where the speech and language person can't make it to the meeting because they're in another part of the county, that they could do it by telephone or they could do it by video conferencing. I'm hoping it's the positive pieces that we use in this. But nonetheless, no matter if we do it at all, it's with parent approval. Mm-hmm. They can't do it without that.
That part I understand, and that's very helpful. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Senator Whitson.
Thank you, Chair Devlin. Mr. Tinney, you spoke of local resolution of legal conflict. And, you know, resolution of legal conflicts locally is a good thing only if it is equitable to both parties. I think that the districts may, and often do, in fact, avoid litigation at all costs, citing the cost of litigation and lack of support from the Department of Education on that litigation effort. The resulting resolution may be unacceptable. It may set expensive precedent for the state. And the question is, do you monitor or do you look at these potential settlements ahead of time and approve them, or do you just accept them as they are?
Chair Devlin, Senator Woodson, thank you for that question. In due process hearings, we don't have a say. That they're judges that make those decisions, which we have very few of. But as far as complaints are concerned in our complaint investigation, we read all of the responses and take a look at them, yes. We read them. We have a team that looks at them and has some questions about, you know, do we really want to do this to the district? Is it going to make a difference? Or do we want to do this to a parent and is it going to make a difference? And we have that conversation before the final orders are put out. Once the orders are put out with the recommendations or the steps that have to happen, we also monitor those. And so if one of them, we had an instance a while back where a school just couldn't meet what they said they would do because the parent wasn't willing to do their end of it. And we had to sit down and talk about how were we going to balance this out. We couldn't keep the district at at that kind of a situation, if they couldn't do anything else about getting a parent to cooperate. And so then we would balance those kinds of recommendations.
And
so we monitor them through to the end of the time frame.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Follow up. Just for my information, could you kind of describe your legal staff to us?
Our legal staff, Chair Devlin, Senator Wistit, we have a full-time legal specialist who's an attorney, and we have a half-time person who monitors the complaints, and a part-time person, about three-tenths of a person or so, that specialist, these are two specialists, that manages the request for mediation and talks to districts or families about trying to go to mediation, or do you need to file a complaint, and monitors and systems, trains in those areas.
Thank you.
One additional question. Under No Child Left Behind, there are testing requirements for students in literally all demographics. One of the complaints that we hear from schools is that, particularly in the area of special education, that parents decline to have their students tested. Is it true that the Act doesn't make any provision for this, and that if you fall below the 95% testing, you've basically failed, but the reason that you have failed is because parents have declined to have their students tested?
Senator Devlin, that's a very good question. Yes and no, to a degree. We're sitting in an interesting situation in Oregon, because No Child Left Behind does say that the 95%, and you do have to have 95% participation rate. In Oregon, because of something called an ASK settlement that we've been involved with for the last 4 years, one of the rules that Oregon has is that parents of students with disabilities can waive participation in statewide assessment due to a disability. The IEP team cannot waive the students, but the parent can. And so when they get to that point, we're sort of at a loss for that. One of the things that districts have told me that they try hard to do is to show students and parents what the tests are like, and that they're really the things that they're learning about. But again, if the parent exercises that right to waive that, and in Oregon right now, that is a problem.
Okay. Is there a possibility of correcting that problem, or is it? This goes actually to a question that Senator, or a statement that Senator Nelson made, I think, last week, is where on one of the state assessments you have a school rated exceptional, and then under No Child Left Behind it's rated as not meeting standards. Is there a way that this is going to be resolved, or?
Chair Devlin, I'm not sure. I think we talk about it a lot. I don't know if with the rule in Oregon, if that should be something we should be looking at with our AYP manual. The other question, of course, that many of the advocates would have is, who exactly are these students, and maybe should they be tested, and is the parent really saying no, and you know, who's saying no? And so those are questions that we have to still look at. It's similar to saying special ed kids can't pass the benchmark. Well, a lot of them can, and 90% of our kids are in general education. So we first have to ask, who are those kids, before we make an assumption.
Okay. Any additional questions from Ms. Lincoln?
I'm going to go into the direct service programs, which are probably a little bit more interesting to everybody at this point. Again, in your handout from today that I know you have, the very last two sheets have a summary of many of the programs that that we are in charge of making sure services to these kids occur, or somebody is doing it for us. We have both state-operated and state-supported programs. Our state-operated programs would be the State School for the Deaf and the State School for the Blind, which are our employees and that we operate directly. We also have state-supported programs that usually happen under contracts with ESDs or school districts. And an example would be our special education early childhood program and our regional programs. I'll start with our regional programs and just touch on each one of these, and feel free to ask questions. The regional program is a grant and aid program. It was created in 1993 by the Oregon legislature to effect a cost-effective means for providing special education services to students with low-incidence, high-need disabilities. These include vision, impairment, hearing impairment, deaf blindness, severe orthopedic impairment, and autism spectrum disorder. These services for these students are provided in 8 regions across the state by contracts with the department. These are services that are required by state law and the federal government under IDEA, but they're not required by a lot of students. They're not needed by a whole lot of students. But for those students who need them, they don't usually all live in the same geographic area. They're spread across the state of Oregon. So therefore, the regional programs we were hoping would then provide that equal access to these services no matter where you live in the state of Oregon. The primary responsibility for the students remained with the district. They didn't have the regional program. The district would be forced to look for that 2-hour therapist a week or the feeding specialist or the mobility specialist, which would be probably a very high expense in a part-time person. The regional programs also then offered the specialized training and also the highly qualified staff and equipment for students in Oregon who need those services. Once those contracts are in place, we meet with the contractors on a regular basis, wanting to make sure that they're in compliance with the services that are needed, that they do proper financial reporting, the consistency and the quality and level of service for kids, and for also identifying other needs. For example, we have a bill right now asking for traumatic brain injury to be added to the list of regional services as of May if districts want it. That came out of a direct request from school districts asking for that help. It's not on the list of services right now for regional, so what we're asking for is it a possibility, may we add it to that? Could it be a possibility? And then we would take some time to look at that. These programs are also under the accountability system for special education. We make sure that they also remain in compliance with the federal laws. The district here that we're talking about, the Ben Lapine District, for students that have low incidence disabilities, they would access the services from the regional program. They currently host one of the administrative offices for the regional services, and they also enroll about 40% of the students in that region are in that school district. They have about 200 students eligible for services. 170 of them are school age and 30 are preschool that are eligible for regional services. And just for your edification, 109 are autism, 30 are deaf, 17 are vision impaired, 25 are orthopedic impairments, and 19 are a combination of these disabilities. These are all kids that are within this school district. This district also is involved in the demonstration models that I talked about for students with autism. They have an early childhood model classroom. They have a primary school, elementary school model classroom, and the middle school classroom is in the neighboring district of Redmond. And I believe that we're going to try a high school model at the Bend School District next year. We also have the Oregon Deafblind Project, which is a special grant and provides services to families and care providers and students around the challenges of raising a child who's deaf and blind. And we also have a consulting teacher that goes out to the district to work with the classroom teachers with these students. In addition to that, the regional program hosts the Oregon Textbook and Media Center, and this provides students across Oregon who are blind or visually impaired with the specialized textbooks and instructional materials, whether they're in Braille, large print, tactile maps and graphs, and other materials, the audio tapes that they might need. The next set of programs have to do with long-term care and treatment. These programs were initiated 27 years ago by the Oregon Legislature to be sure that the educational funding was available for students placed in these residential and grade treatment centers by the Department of Human Services, and that these students would be staying there for 3 months or longer is when we would call it long-term care or treatment. So under law, we're responsible for these services, and again, we contract out to districts and ESDs for delivering the services. There are about 30 school districts and ESDs that contract with us for these programs. There are 52 residential or day treatment programs. The sizes of those programs run from 5 students to 72 students. The cost of these programs are pretty significant. They're pretty much higher than the typical student. Again, these are kids with severe mental health needs. These would not be kids that could easily fit into a general ed classroom, nor should they, and need the additional supports that the traditional student would not need. There are two long-term care and treatment centers in the Ben Lafayette area. They're located within that district, but they are served by the ESD's contracts. One is a day treatment center that has 15 students in it. 11 are eligible for special education, and they range in age from 3 to 12. And the other one is a new psychiatric residential program that serves 12 students ages 3 to 18. And 9 of these are eligible for special education. We're pretty excited to be able to open a residential center in that part of the state so that these kids wouldn't have to be so far away from home and so far away from the services that they need. This has run a very structured academic program, and it's run with a therapeutic environment. Included in that, then, would be the hospital programs. And we have two sets of kids in hospital programs. We have the set of kids who are acute or chronic medical conditions that require extended stays, like cancer treatments, burns, orthopedic needs, head injuries, those kinds of services that are provided at Dornbecker, Legacy, and Shriners. We provide the educational parts of those programs. And we also have students that are hospitalized in one of our Oregon state hospitals, whether in Salem or in Portland, with serious mental health conditions as well. These services begin after we know a student's going to be there for 5 days or longer, and again are worked in concert with the medical treatment. Some of these kids are not ready after cancer treatment for their education. It's not the most important thing to them right away, and we wait to make sure that the medical piece is in place for them. None of these programs, of course, are in the Ben Lapine area. They're all in the metro area. And the next set of programs are the youth corrections education programs. These provide public education programs to youth who have committed criminal offenses, causing them to be placed in one of the 10 Oregon Youth Authority programs, correctional facilities. In 1993, the legislature gave the department responsibility for providing the educational services to these students. Local districts, again, and ESDs are contract with the department to provide these services. The average daily membership in 2003-2004 was about 850 students, ages 12 to 25. The capacity of these facilities range from 25 students to 400. And none of these programs are located in the Ben Lapine area. Juvenile detention programs, however, there is one in Ben Lapine area, and they do contract directly with us to provide the services. These are the programs that have 15 detention centers across the state, serving about 320 students. And these are short-term placements for youth who have some kind of offense and they're waiting adjudication in the juvenile court system. And most of these programs operate in very small facilities with limited classroom space. The district, Ben Lapine, that does have the detention center, serves about 26 students. 11 of these students are coming from their own district. The average length of stay, very short term, 3 to 5 days. And the last set of programs that are under this are state-operated programs, to be the State School for the Deaf and the State School for the Blind. State School for the Deaf is in operation since 1870. And they operate on a statewide services for students who are deaf or hard of hearing and a campus-based residential and non-residential setting. The School for the Blind is in operation since 1873, and both of these schools partner with the local districts for students who need a less restrictive setting or expanded educational options. These students are placed through the IEP process, through the districts making the determination that this would be the best place for them for a period of time. Those, again, are reviewed. Both schools are subjected to all of the requirements under IDEA, and placements for each of these students is reviewed annually, including the district and the parent. The program is a comprehensive K-12 academic program, and it focuses on the accommodations that these kids would need for their deaf or blind disabilities.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Could I ask why? I know we're only getting 4% federal funds for these schools, while under the other programs that serve the regional programs, we're getting like 42%. Is there any way of adding federal funds into this category?
Probably not without affecting maintenance of effort.
Okay.
Yes, Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Are any of our deaf and blind students mainstreamed in the schools, and how many
of these special students are in Washington State or Idaho? Is there any look at, you know, regionalizing or consolidating?
Chair Devlin, Senator Wisnant, that's a very good question that's been asked before, especially in the eastern part of the state. These are all Oregon students, and yes, they are mainstreamed into some of our schools in the Salem-Keizer School District, and actually we've had students that have attended Chemeketa Community College as well, as they're ready for expanded options. We see to that. All of the students starting at age 14 have some kind of a work plan or a transition plan in place for getting ready for that adult living community. Put this into context, we have about 44 students at School for the Blind, five of whom commute, the rest of them are in the area. And for the School for the Deaf, about 129, and 50% of those students commute. But they're all Oregon students.
Mr. Chair, my follow-up question is, how many of these special students does the state of Washington or Idaho have? And they have schools for the blind and for the deaf.
Chair Devlin, Representative Wisnant, I do believe both of them do. I know Washington does. The reason I'm guessing that Idaho does is because we were asked in Eastern Oregon about a student going there instead of coming to the Salem District School.
Please proceed. Senator Whitson.
Chair Devlin, just some quick figures here. That's about $117,000 a year per student.
Chair Devlin, Senator Whitson, yes, and that includes the dorm living and the cost of the dorm staff.
How many years do these blind and deaf children normally attend those schools?
Chair Devlin, Senator Whitson, I think it varies. I know when I was in the district, we had students that were there for maybe 2 years or 3 years, maybe 1 year. Some students that may be there for their most of their career or their school education.
How is that determined?
By the individual education plan, including the district, the state school, and the parent.
Okay.
And it's reviewed annually.
Thank you.
Please proceed. Any additional questions?
There's one final direct service program that we would like to talk about, and that's our early childhood program. We kept that separate because it is a whole unit by itself. When the superintendent of public instruction started her office, she made it very clear that she wanted a single unit speaking for all the young learners in Oregon. We had three different offices working with different kids in early childhood, and we weren't even all in the same building. And so we were put under one umbrella, and it was a very good decision. I'll tell you a few things that have happened since we became one unit. We now are piloting a statewide observational assessment for all young children in Oregon who are served under programs in the Department of Education. Interestingly enough, there are some of the private daycare facilities who also want to be a part of this assessment and to be a part of the process, and we're actually using them as part of the pilot. The system is based on a set of foundations or content standards that were developed by a statewide group of people who either work with young children directly or work in agencies that serve young children. And the assessment is based on that. It's not a paper-pencil test. It's a test where teachers will observe the children in the natural environments on a variety of areas that are important for readiness for school. We're pretty excited about this because, again, it's a response from the legislature about what is it that we do and how do we know we're making a difference for the kids that we're serving. It's easy to say the individual education plan will answer that question. Those are not standardized. It's not a way to take a look at the statewide system. And so this will hopefully be a part of something that we'll be able to, in the next session, give you some more information on. Second thing that we did was we were able to create a child database, which ties all of our students on identification numbers similar to the school age program. You heard Doug Costi talk last week about the KID system, and by us starting our database now that's similar and it's all part of the secure student ID system, that we also will be a part with our young children in this program, in the KID system. What that will mean for us is we can follow any of the students that have stay in Oregon with that number and their performance. And is there a difference if they've been in a preschool program or not in a preschool program, and how are they progressing? So we're pretty excited about being a whole part of the PK-12 system. We're also able to encourage other agencies that work with young children to commit to the focus of Ready for School. We have a lot of people doing a lot of things for young children, and we tried to get together to talk more about all of us should be here for the purpose of getting these kids ready for school. And so the management team across the agencies as well talk to each other to make sure staff is working together and that we're focusing on that. I'm going to share a little bit of information about each of our early childhood programs that we have. Talk about the Federal Head Start and Oregon Pre-K program, early intervention, early childhood special ed program, and I'll talk a little bit about the Even Start program. This morning when I was driving in, I heard something that was astonishing to me. Poor kids come to kindergarten with an average vocabulary of 5,000 words. They're more advantaged peers, and it's actually just this morning, I have to write it down because I know I was coming here today. Their average normal or more advantaged peers come to kindergarten with 20,000 vocabulary words. Pretty astonishing. Our pre-kindergarten program, Oregon legislature enacted in 1987 to provide a comprehensive program of childhood development, school readiness for our poorest and most needy 3- and 4-year-olds. The program enables the children that living in poverty to start school more ready and to learn and be a little bit more ahead of, along with their more advantaged peers. The program is designed to meet individual needs of students based on their observations versus looking at language, literacy, math, and social skills. The program also emphasizes strengthening family needs by making sure that we make proper referrals to the community agencies if they need them, and also having parents get more actively involved in their child's education in hopes that that'll continue as they go on through school. Hopefully you have with you or in your black notebook biennial legislative report that is required of us, so you'll have more detailed information in there about the program in the last year or so. The law in Oregon at this point requires our Oregon pre-kindergarten program to operate according to the federal Head Start standards. By doing that and maintaining a 90% parity, our program benefits a great deal. We're able to get all the training that Head Start offers free of charge. We're able to support our monitoring efforts and making sure that our programs are safe and in compliance with what we expect them to be doing. And also the local sites that have early childhood programs can use the money for the Head Start from our OPK program to leverage Head Start money as their matching funds. So the Head Start program, sometimes people get real confused about this. The federal Head Start program has funds that flow directly to community agencies that have Head Start programs. They have a little bit of money that comes to the department for monitoring purposes, for dissemination of information, and to have a liaison person in our office. Then we have the OPK funds, and those go out under a grantee award. And so people have to submit a request for those funds, and they're selected based on that. We leverage funds then from the federal government, from the federal Head Start, because we put our money in with the Head Start program, and it can expand the options for kids. Our OPK funds are in every Head Start program in Oregon, but we also have 9 programs that are straight OPK-funded programs that don't have Head Start money in them. Is that any more clear to anybody? Therein lies why we call our kindergarten program, which is very confusing to me, the Oregon Head Start Pre-Kindergarten Program, shortly called OPK.
Okay.
Yes.
To clarify then, so that when we say under the current biennium's budget, we have 60% of eligible children covered or participating, we're talking about all of those programs.
Yes, Senator Devlin, we are talking about all of the programs together.
Okay. Right.
I can.
Yes.
As I was just saying, now under the governor's budget, we were going to cut out about 1,000 pre-K, is that our Head Start program?
From 60 to about 53%, I guess.
Yes, Chair Devlin, Senator Nelson, we were going to cut $14 million out of the budget, which would reduce us back to a couple of years ago, 53%.
How does that mean in number of students?
Nine hundred. You might explain that the cost per student, I think, is a little bit less than $8,000.
Yes, sir.
But that's because there's a broad host of services that are offered beyond instruction. So,
Senator Devlin, yes, what's expected is that we do some of the screenings and we make referrals for the services that families need to other agencies. So we look at the family strengths and the family services as well as the education program.
Well, in the House and Senate budget both restore some of that money. I think one of them restores all of it and one of them restores half of it or something. I don't know which one.
Yeah.
I was trying to say, how many students are we actually affecting? I mean,
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, right now, just on the state-funded side, we're funding about 3,500 kids a year. Under the governor's budget, we'd be down to about 2,600, so about 900 kids a year.
See, I had that 1,000 figure in my mind. I don't know where I got that from.
Please proceed, and we have about 40 minutes left for the next presentation. So,
I'll go quickly through these. In this selected district in Van Lapine, they have 5 different sites where we host programs for the pre-kindergarten programs. High school students are also involved in those programs with teaching children about nutrition and doing some of the things out of their family developmental classes. Then we have the early intervention, early childhood special education programs. These programs were enacted in 1989, Oregon, under Senate Bill 1146, transferred the responsibilities for this program to the Department of Education from the Department of Human Services. We have 9 contracts with ESDs, again, sort of like a regional concept, that serve the students that are in the special education programs. These are kids with significant disabilities. We're funded under both state and federal funds and Medicaid reimbursement as much as possible. Programs are subjected to all the monitoring processes that we talked about earlier. The early intervention program is a program for kids from birth through 2 years old that have significant disabilities. And we work with them either in their homes or in the community services, in community sites. The early childhood special ed program is a program for children from ages 3 to 5. The reason they're separate is they're really 2 different federal funding streams. So we have to keep them separate even though we have a seamless system. So we have, and oftentimes in our seamless system, it'll be the same teachers teaching the birth to 2 and the 3 to 5 because of that seamless system. But that there is the difference between the numbers of students and how we talk about early intervention, birth through 2, early childhood special ed is 3 to 5. These students also are in some of the daycare centers, the OPK and Head Start programs that we have, and oftentimes at home. These are kids with the significant disabilities, the obvious disabilities. We're not talking about the kids who might potentially have disabilities, so they're pretty obvious. In 3 years ago, 84% of the kids that were going into kindergarten, going from the early intervention to early childhood from age 3 from age 2 to age 3 program, 84% of them continued in the program, which meant several of the students did not continue there. Whatever needs they had were no longer there. This year we calculated that 91% of our kids are staying within the program, meaning that they probably have far more significant disabilities than they've had in the past. The Even Start program, just real quickly, it's a very small federal program, totally funded out of federal funds. It's under $2 million, and it really focuses on families with children birth to 5 and literacy. So they're helping the parents get through schools, maybe getting their GEDs or getting their high school diplomas, going through literacy programs, and also working on some of the developmental skills with the parents and the students. Any questions on our pre-K?
Yes, Senator Wexler.
Chair Devlin, Mr. Tini. Going back to your budget and your funding a little bit, like on the regional programs, this comes out to about $7,250 a student or whatever. Now, is that in addition to the average daily weighted contribution of those children, or is it in addition to the 2x average daily weighted contribution from the formula?
Mr. Chair, Senator Whitsett, this is in addition to any funding they have at their school district.
So that would be in addition to the 2X for the special ed students.
Right. And typically these students would only be in the regional program services part of the time and would be in their regular school districts the rest of the time.
So essentially it would actually be about three times that much.
Can I get, which age group are we talking about?
Talking about regional programs.
Okay. Senator Devlin, Senator Whitsett, there was an acknowledgement when those programs were created that there was a low incidence of those the populations of kids and a high need represented. And so it really is effectively extra money to provide special services for those populations to supplement what districts can provide in their basic educational programs in the mainstream.
I understand that, if I may. But what I was trying to get at is the actual cost. I'm not commenting on whether what the actual, you know, how you're spending the money. I'm looking at the actual cost, and the actual cost is about three times what the budgeted amount there is. Is that also true of the long-term care and treatment education? Does that also have another 2X added to that?
Yes. Chair Devlin, Senator Whitsett, the students in long-term care and treatment would actually be in a place. They wouldn't be in the school district.
So that would be, that would be exclusive of the 2X there.
Right.
Okay. And that would also obviously be true of the hospital program and the youth corrections program also. And the School of Deaf and Blind also. So when we get down to the last year program, your EIESCSE program, is that also, does that have an additional 2X? So just be the one regional program. Thank you.
Representative March.
Let me clarify that and back up to the regional programs. You've got students served at 7279. That's for 1 year. That's an annual year.
Mm-hmm.
The budget is for a biennial period. Is, okay,
yes.
So really, if that number held fairly steady, you're serving 14,000 students at 52.8. 14,000 divided by, the 52.8 divided by 14,000 divided by, would come out to about 3,600 or something like that.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sue, this is for you. The numbers on our sheet that we did, the prioritization, are different than what we're seeing here. Big differences in regional programs. Looks like we, in our sheet, was 41 million, 41.5. Long term is pretty close. Hospital is pretty close. Youth corrections is 27 million on our sheet. The schools for deaf and blind are pretty close, and then the last one, I count up 124. What do we?
What's the difference? Representative Wisnett, the information that the department is presenting to you is on the current budget for 0305, and your priority list work that you did was on the governor's budget proposed for 0507.
So this is more correct.
This is for the 0305 biennium.
Okay,
the priority list are for the 0507 governor's proposed budget.
Thank you. Don't worry about
it. Any additional questions?
Oranges and pineapples.
Representative Jensen.
Kind of a variety of questions, a number of questions, and I'll probably go back a little bit. As I look at the report card and other things, I see a fairly dramatic increase in the number of special ed students. students slash, I suppose, programs over the last decades. Now, there you have frequent sort of explanations of this are A, that we're better diagnosing, better at diagnosing maybe some of these problems now than we were a decade ago. Though for those of us that go back two decades before the 90s, we don't really like to think we were in the dark ages in the 90s, sort of thing. But and other explanations, you know, go on with even such devious hypothesis as that it's a way for school districts to pad their budget, you know, a little bit. And I guess where I'm going with my question, Mr. Chair, is that do we have any definitive studies as to what is the cause of this increase? Studies that probably have been replicated and peer-reviewed so that we could hang our hat on their reliability.
Chair Devlin, Representative Jensen, good question. At this stage of the game, what we can best compare ourselves to is all the other states in the nation, and there's a report from Congress that comes out annually, and at this point, the trend has been an increase nationally, probably almost at a 29.8% over the same period of time. Oregon right now is like about, there are 25 states under us as far as the percent of kids that we identify as special education, so we're kind of right in the middle. I think you notice there's some leveling off at this stage of the game. I think nobody is talking about what that accounts for, but I do think that it's evident in the new law when they're putting 15% of the IDEA money toward general education pre-referral, that they're trying to look at different ways of looking at less students in special education and seeing what students are, those that could be best served in other ways.
I follow.
Yes.
If we follow the old adage around this building of follow the money, we would somewhat expect a leveling off because the federal money kind of tapers out at this particular level or just a little below that at, where we're at now. But what I'm hearing you say is there are no studies of this type, and that's probably not the jurisdiction or the responsibility of this Ways and Means to implement a study of that magnitude. But it does strike me that this increase may come from a variety of things, and some of the causes that might be the reasons for this increase are not necessarily going to be fixed at the school level. They may be more of societal, you know, or even genetic types of causations. And it would be very helpful, and we can't do anything about that other than encourage the department to perhaps seek from their counterparts around the rest of the states some studies that will explain for us pretty accurately this increase. One additional question, if I may, Mr.
Yeah.
Chair. I note in Oregon statutes that the TAG program is a special education program, and I hear no reference to it this morning in your presentation. And is there a reason for that, or are we... what is the reason for that would be a better way to phrase that question, I guess.
Chair Devlin, Representative Jensen, talented and gifted programs are not part of the IDEA special education law. It was the TAG program in Oregon was housed in the special ed office until last year when it was moved to the curriculum office.
So I've got somebody else I want to beat up on that.
I wanted to also add, there's a very good question about the studies, and we'll look into some of our university counterparts to see if there is anything available, and if not, would they be interested?
Thank you.
Senator Whitson.
Just a couple more questions about, as Representative Jensen was saying, follow the money. There's about, depending on which ESD we converse with, there's about 70% to 100% of their money is funded into special education. Is that reflected in these figures?
Senator Devlin, Senator Woodsett, I don't know if they're reflected in there. These are programs that are the contracts. Would they be represented in? Yes, they are. I'm hearing them. Yes, they are.
The ESD numbers are in those. Very good.
In addition to the program, the school-age general programs that they provide services.
And if I may, there's also one other line item, I think a $24 million that is allocated to profoundly disabled students. Where does that show up in this budget? For the 5X students within the formula?
For the high cost disability?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Where does that
show up in this?
It would be in the state school fund because that is part of the state school fund.
So that would be in addition to the 2X then on the regional part. There'd be another $24 million there.
It's capped at.
It's capped at $12 million.
Yeah. I think that issue will be debated again when we do the school formula, but my understanding is the current intent is to keep it capped at the same level.
You raised the bar.
So the short answer is?
Maybe you can explain. They're going to raise the bar in terms of the level of expenditures that are necessary to qualify, but they're going to keep the same cap so that more of this. Well, the cap on the amount that can go out.
When the Finance Committee took a look at the first request submissions, we found that by raising the bar 5,000, we could reduce almost 50% of the submissions that came in so that those school districts with truly high-cost kids would get more of the funding that they were requesting if it was prorated.
Mm-hmm.
And those are, those requests come directly from districts, not from regional program staff or early childhood or anything. It's from the school district, per se, for high-cost kids.
So, Chair, what I'm trying to get at on the regional programs with those 7,279 students, we have an expenditure of $52.8 million plus the 2X on the weighted average daily admission or attendance plus the whatever that allocation, $12 million a year, $24 million per biennium for the profoundly disabled students. Is that correct?
Yes, they wouldn't necessarily all be regional kids that would fall under the high-cost disability.
Then where would that go?
Well, they would be other high-cost kids that might be a mentally retarded child, for example, mm-hmm. that need some unique services that wouldn't fall under regional services.
Then which service would that fall into?
It would fall under the school district request for not a placement here, but within the regular school system. So that child is in the regular class or in the school district and has high cost. That school district is submit on that child, and he wouldn't necessarily have to be in one of these programs.
Just a further clarification.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, if I may, for the record, Brett West from the Office of Finance and Administration. Senator Whitsitt, I think the questions you're asking are related to the general fund that goes out to the state school fund and aren't reflected in the dollar amounts that you see here. Some of these students that you do see here are part of the state school fund formula, but not all of the students that you see here. So for some students in the state school fund formula, they would get the special ed weighting, and they would get a portion of that additional $12 million per year that we set aside for the high-cost disability students, those that are well above currently $25,000. Nancy's presentation wasn't focused on that at this part of the program because she was mostly focused on the federal funds. But I think your question is, do these funds interact and supplement each other? The answer to that is yes, for some but not all of the students that we show on this sheet. Does that help answer your question?
It actually muddles it a little more. I mean, I'm trying to follow the dollars through the disability programs, and it's practically impossible. And from your explanation, that clarifies why it's impossible.
Mr. Chair, Senator Woods, I think what I can do is we can go back and try and put something down on paper that might be a little more understandable for you and bring it back as we talk about the state school fund tomorrow.
Well, perhaps I'm the only one on the panel that's confused with that, but
I think maybe what would be helpful is if you would, this is very muddled, I recognize that, to try to actually, but if you could present the highest cost aid situation and what would be the normal just double weighting, which would be fairly understandable, but the highest weight cost would be when all those factors come into place, all the factors that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Being part of the regional, being double weighted, and also being eligible for the 12 million.
Mm-hmm. We can, Mr. Chair, we can do that.
In trying to follow that through, those dollars through the system, it's unclear whether there's a lot of money going into it, which is unclear where it's being spent. But I think that's something that we should, you know, if we're going to be accountable, we should know where those money's being spent.
So. We'll help you do that.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Ms. Fleming, we probably have time for only one of your two next presenters. So before we get to our...
Devlin, I'm told that they can whiz through their presentation in less than 20 minutes and leave time at the end for your invited testimony.
Okay. We will try that.
All right. Then next.
My committee is always a very inquisitive committee.
Yes, so. I know. If you don't ask any questions, we'll be able to do this. Dr. Pat,
please Burke ask whatever questions you feel necessary to ask. I'm not going to...
Just by way of introduction, Dr. Pat Burke and Brian Reeder will be presenting on the Systems Accountability and Policy Development Office. This is a newly created unit, and it really speaks to the need for the agency to continue its transition. It happens to be one of our smallest units at this point in time, and probably at some point needs to be our largest. So I'll move back and let them.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Pat Burke, Chief Policy Officer for the Department of Education. We understand your time dilemma, and my colleague Brian Reeder and I will try to move very quickly. As my colleague Ms. Fleming just told you, this is a new department as a result of the reorganization of the agency and a refocusing of our priorities. And one of the key questions driving all of our work, as we have been testifying before this committee, is the question of accountability for results and management for results. So the purpose of system accountability and policy development, our mission, is to provide the right data at the right time. We take that very seriously and try to prepare and present accurate and useful information. Our purpose in this relatively small part of the agency is to provide to schools, districts, to yourselves, to policymakers, and to the general public accurate, understandable, and timely data and analysis to assist schools, districts, and policymakers in measuring the performance of the system itself and in informing the decisions related to system improvement, effectiveness, and efficiency. As we have been describing in our testimony before Ways and Means, the three priorities of the agency are accountability, leadership, and improvement. This part of our operation provides accountability through having the best data that we can produce to evaluate the system performance and the shared accountability for results at all levels of the enterprise. So it's not just information for the agency, but it's information for school boards, as I mentioned, for the legislature, for the general public, for a variety of policy and decision makers being accountable for results. We provide leadership and analyzing information and asking hard questions of ourselves and of the system and providing that information publicly. And we focus on improvement of the system by providing in-depth analysis of student outcomes and analysis of effective practices and other key factors related to student success. So let me give you a couple of thoughts about how we go about doing that. One of the priority areas that we have identified is that this unit should be a source of accurate data. And that includes information on school and district characteristics, achievement, student performance of state goals, and other performance indicators, school funding issues, teacher characteristics, administrator characteristics, financial characteristics of the state and district, graduation and dropout characteristics, current and historical data, and a variety of others. Some of the products that we produce, we manage the uploading of information and the clarification of information in the database initiative. And an example of the use of that has been before the committee, where my colleague Brian Reeder demonstrated software that we have available for policymakers, yourselves, and others to ask questions of the DBI data. We produced the state report card even this morning. Several questions arose where information in the state report card has been referenced by the committee. Pulling that information together, presenting that booklet to you and to others in a useful, readable fashion is very important. We produce the dropout and graduation rate data. We provide in-depth analysis and can account for 99.5% of all of the students attending Oregon high schools over a four-year period of time. We are currently working on the ODE performance measures, and this has been discussed before the committee. When we inherited the agency 2 years ago, the performance measures in place were basically not measurable and not related to our goals. And we began the process of redesigning those performance measures. They are prepared for a first read by the state board at its April meeting. It will go to the state board for second read and adoption at the May meeting, and we'll go to the progress board by June, which is the targeted delivery date. And we're also responsible for federal policy compliance. The definitions of the compliance documents, particularly those related to No Child Left Behind, are undergo continuous review. We have just completed our fourth letter of amendment to that work plan. That's an annual event for state departments to work through the definitions and clarify the operations related to adequate yearly progress. We do a lot of policy analysis, particularly in the effective use of resources, equity in funding, and outcome of those fundings, and looking at the trade-offs among priorities. Let me just cite two recent examples. On our website, you will now find an in-depth analysis of English as second language funding, or the half weight that's in the funding formula. For the first time, we have been able to track the number of students identified by districts, the amount of resource received under the funding formula, the amount the districts report spending on those programs, and the results that they are getting with that. We think that type of in-depth analysis is crucial to decision makers. Mr. Chair.
For the record, we will have a discussion on that issue tomorrow.
Excellent.
On a budget note relative to that.
Excellent. It's relatively new work using new technology that we have available to us, and we think it offers a lot of promise.
Does that include, Mr. Chair, that report back tomorrow? Will that include a document that captures how those districts are spending those dollars?
I have seen a relatively short document that the superintendent's office has prepared. On something else specific than that. So it should include that.
Thank you.
And we have that information available, Senator Gordon.
Thank you.
I might also point out a recent body of work that this department did to analyze the impact of the Multnomah County special income tax, particularly answering a critical question: are students in the eight districts in Multnomah County making academic progress, and is the achievement gap being closed? We utilized new technology using the secured student identifier to be able to monitor districts and our students in the same district over a three-year period of time. This allows a much more in-depth analysis of student data than we've been able to do before. This part of the agency also manages the work of the Quality Education Commission. As I've testified before, there are about 18 states in the United States that have something like the QEC or some body analyzing state funding. However, The Oregon operation is one of only a few. I only know of one other with an actual appointed commission by the governor and ongoing work in this area. There are three basic models of this work: a professional judgment model, which Oregon uses, a data analysis model, and a best practices model. And one of the implications of Senate Bill 38, which of course has not yet been passed, but Senate Bill 38 would assign to the Quality Education Commission the task of analyzing in depth any barriers in the current school funding formula to moving more resources to the classroom level. This would move the work of the QEC from just the professional development model to more of a data analysis model. The commission also has provided in-depth papers on high school improvement and closing the achievement gap, and continues to work on clarifying where the money is in the state. And I would just emphasize that at least our approach to the QEC continues to be, as it has always been, that the QEC is a tool for you to analyze state expenditure, not necessarily a rationale for more money. The power of the QEC and the quality education model is a set of clearly measured indicators and being able to use that information to analyze the state school funding formula. So let me turn quickly, Mr. Chair, to my colleague, Mr. Reeder, who will provide you some additional information.
Before we go on the QEC.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Each year that it's updated, is it updated relative to current cost factors?
Mr. Chair, yes, it is. One of the parts of the work that we provide in support to the QEC is to continually update the financial information system, particularly that information that's in DBI, and then upload that into the QEM so that it's always using current data.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Mm-hmm. Chair Devlin, for the record, Brian Reeder, Director of the Policy Research and Analysis Section at the Department of Education. I just want to very briefly expand a little bit, provide a little more detail on what Pat spoke about. Really, the challenge of this newly formed office in the department, really two pieces to that challenge. The first is to, in essence, get our data act together, as you probably recall in some previous discussions, like many other departments in governments, not just in Oregon, but I think in other states as well, data within departments tends to be spread around within the department in different offices. What we're attempting to do here at the Department of Ed is get all that data in one place and have it, in essence, at our fingertips so that we can answer questions very quickly. We can provide data to people who need it very quickly, and that we know that that data is the most recent data available. That is one of the primary tasks of this office, and we are making great progress in doing that. Really, the second major task is to be able to use that data to provide sort of the analytical capability to evaluate that data to help policymakers make better decisions. And those policymakers would include yourselves, the governor's office, the superintendent of public instruction, school boards, school superintendents, ESDs, and we also make it a very high priority to provide accurate data to the press and to the public when they ask for it. To do this work, the section currently has 9 FTE, a director, a program specialist who is responsible for our work related to performance measures, 5 research analysts, and 2 administrative support staff. As Pat mentioned, a small office currently. So why is it that we do this work? And that really the goal there here is to improve the effectiveness and the efficiency of the education system in Oregon. The ultimate goal of the department is to improve outcomes for kids, and the role of this office in bringing that about is to help policymakers make better decisions so that the system as a whole runs more efficiently and we get the most bang for our buck. And how do we do that? We do In addition to having the best data available at our disposal, we do analysis that helps us understand what activities and allocation of resources results in the best student outcomes possible. Just as an example that Pat already mentioned, the recent work that we've done related to the achievement gap for students with limited English proficiency. We have student-level data on the performance of LEP students and also non-LEP or general students. We can evaluate the expenditures that districts make on English as a second language programs and try to determine whether those expenditures are effective at closing the achievement gap between LEP students and non-LEP students. It's that kind of analysis that this office is capable of doing and is doing in order to help policymakers make better decisions. How can we do that kind of work better? Again, related to data and to analysis, we need to continue our efforts to improve the quality and the timeliness of our data and also build our capacity to use that data to ask critical policy questions. The focus of the office, since it was formed roughly a year ago, has been on questions related to resource allocation and how that affects student performance, and that will remain a major focus of the office. But as the office grows, also get into additional questions related to things such as special education and so forth. With that, I think I'll stop and answer any questions you may have.
Senator Jordan.
Thank you very much, Mr. Reeder, Dr. Berg. As policymakers, please share with us what opportunities are we missing to better utilize the quality education model and the capacity of the commission to help us with analysis. What opportunities are we missing?
Chair Devlin, Senator Gordley, I think the hope of the commission is that the model will be a tool that any interested person, any legislator, or any school district can use to answer questions related to school funding in Oregon. And in terms of an opportunity to do that, I think there are two ways. You can get a copy of the model and work with it yourself, or if that's not an appealing thing to you, then someone in my office is happy to come and sit down with you and help you use the model, sort of step you through the model, how it works, and sort of in some sense teach you how to use the model so that you can use it yourself. Alternatively, if you have questions, if you have no interest in using the model yourself but have questions you'd like to ask of the model, then we can ask those questions for you and provide you the answers that the model gives us.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, in addition to that, I would say that one of the real advantages of the model is that it clarifies the complexity of school improvement and understanding the model, particularly the model as prototype, that is, it's extrapolated from real Oregon data. So these are real numbers based on real Oregon schools, and shows how those numbers are interconnected, so that asking basic questions about the cost of physical education with a specialist, or what is the implication of raising class size from 35 to 40, and how does that play out not only with the cost of more teachers, but all of the other ripple effects of how changes in the formula are interconnected. Again, as I said before, not as a rationale for more money, but an understanding of how the money works in a real school setting, and then using real Oregon dollars to analyze that.
And I appreciate the distinction that you make there. Thank you.
Representative Wisnett, then Senator Nelson, and then we have to go on to invited testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Reeder, I haven't dealt with Dr. Burke that much, but thank you for all your information. It's always been timely, and I appreciate that. I think we've got the handle on providing the data. My question to you is, you know, your office is called Policy Development, and I'm not sure I understand you want to provide the data to other people to make decisions. My question to you, does the superintendent or did ODE initiate any bills to implement policy this year, and you think you should take on more of a initiative in the policy area? Thank you.
Senator Devlin, Representative Wisnett, I'm going to have to defer to Pat Burke on that question. I personally was not involved in any development of bills for the department this year. I know that we did introduce some bills, but I would have not been involved in the particulars of those. The section within the Office of Policy Development, which is called the Policy Research and Analysis section, is the section of which I direct, and our primary goal is policy analysis, not policy development. So I'm going to have to defer to Pat on the questions of policy development.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Wisnett, there are two areas that we initiated that in part are related to policy analysis. The first was funding for early childhood education, and the second was our request for funding of the data integration system. We can do this work better if we take advantage of tools like the Secured Student Identifier and integrate our data system so that we can do even more analysis. And our thinking there, Representative Wisnett, was that as a first step to being able to do more, we have to concentrate on the quality and efficiency of the data gathering and analysis. Currently, I venture to say if you were to ask districts, this is an area where improvement is really needed. The whole process of collecting, reporting, feedback for validation, then uploading into the database. This is very timely and somewhat cumbersome, it would be the right word, and for smaller and rural districts with small staffs, it's somewhat of a burden on them right now. So one of our pieces of legislation would be to target that and to improve that system.
Quick follow-up, Mr. Chair. I appreciate all the comments you've made, but I'm still looking, you know, I'm looking for the ODE and the superintendent for some more leadership. And it's great to have all this data, but if we just have the data and we don't get any further towards what we're after, which is quality education for our students, then we're not getting it. So I don't need a comment, just a response. Thank you.
Just briefly, Senator Devlin, Representative Wisnett, I'll just give you one example where I think the department has shown some leadership, and that is in the area of closing the achievement gap. The superintendent has made that one of her priorities, and the analysis that my office has done in relationship to limited English proficiency students, I think, is a great example of where the department can use its data gathering and analytical capabilities to shed some light on those issues and provide some direction for policymakers about, you know, what may be effective policy decisions and what may not.
At this point, Senator Nelson, do you have a question? We have about 15 minutes reserved for Mr. Meyer from the Front Turn Network, so if you ask a question.
I hate to be such a nitpicky guy, but we're talking about data and your analysis. You say you have 9 FTE in the department, and in the back it actually shows 10. And it's just a matter of confidence, I guess. It's, you know, what does it matter? Is it 10? And then that's probably a nitpicky thing. It's not really that crucial. But I'm thinking maybe tomorrow or sometime I could just get back some sort of written statement or some sort of documentation of how you're going to combine No Child Left Behind with the Oregon Report Card and what you're working on there. That's kind of where I'm going. Tell Rob not to leave. I'm done. I just...
Representative Senator Devlin, Senator Nelson, the reason for the difference between 10 and 9 is that the assistant superintendent position is currently vacant, and a decision about replacing that position has not been made. So the current figure of resource assigned to this department is 9.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your presentation. Mr. Meyer, could you come forward?
And Mr. Chair, as Mr. Meyer is coming up, if I could just make this comment about the quality of leadership being provided by the Department of Education under the leadership of Superintendent Castillo. I speak as the person who has been an observer and worked with the district over 2 decades, going back to 1979. And I will say this for the record, that this is the first time that we have had a quality of leadership around closing the achievement gap and all those issues with making sure that and being committed to all children succeeding in our Oregon schools. This is the first administration that we've had that has taken this on as a priority and as a commitment and put all of its energies and resources behind that effort. So again, just to provide some historical perspective.
Mr. Meyer, thank you, Senator Burley. Mr. Meyer, could you identify yourself for the record and give us a brief presentation so we have 2 minutes for questions?
Yes, I can. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Rob Myers. I live in Condon. I'm here on behalf of the Frontier Learning Network. I will talk fairly quickly because those of you who know me know I can't say anything in 15 minutes. But 1996-97, we started to look at how we were going to meet Oregon's Education Act for the 21st century, and realizing that that rural schools in our area didn't necessarily have the staff or the resources to be able to do a lot of the elective type things that that the 21st century act would create a necessity to do, started thinking about how we were going to address those needs through distance learning program. And to make a very long story short, after about 3 years of looking at it, we began to create what became the Frontier Learning Network. In 1999, we brought that concept to the legislature, and because it was a fundamentally good idea, the legislature funded it in the amount of $1 million per biennium. It passed overwhelmingly in the House and unanimously in the Senate. And I'd like to take just one more opportunity to thank Senator Gordley once again for her support. Frontier rural students have no greater friend than Senator Gordley, and we appreciate it. The Frontier Network is now funded at about $640,000 per biennium. The brochure that you're looking at is about 3 years old, and there's been some changes in it. I'm not associated formally with the Frontier Network anymore. Haven't been for about 3 years. I do it on an advocacy basis, and I'm not paid out of Frontier Network funds. Just so you know that I don't have a personal dog in this fight. We feel it's a valuable program. It's certainly valuable in terms of the services and the programs it provides to Frontier rural students. The courses that we offer are basically within four disciplines: business, natural resources, information technology, and health services. And the types of courses, the number of courses, will vary based on the needs demonstrated by the schools. The school districts come to the North Central ESD, of which the Frontier Learning Network is a part, and suggest the types of courses that they'd be able to utilize in their curricula. So that's the type of thing the Frontier Learning Network does. We offer courses that are primarily two-way interactive video courses. We utilize four mobile classrooms that were a part of the original funding process. We had those built in Springfield to try to keep the money local. And what we try to do is basically create a situation where Frontier rural students are afforded, to a certain extent, the same types of educational opportunities they are in urban Oregon. And I think it's important to understand that those of us who are involved in the education of rural kids don't necessarily demand that our kids get the same level of courses that is offered in the rural in the excuse me in the urban areas. The typical urban high school has about 200 courses. The typical high school in our area offers 40, and we don't claim that that's not fair. Basically, what we're saying is that in order to make them equal, you'd have to have either 200 courses in both places or 40 in both places, and neither of those is a workable solution. What we do say is that 40 is probably the bottom, and we would like to be considered as somewhere near a basic service level in terms of not being able to, being forced to go any lower than that. Just as important, we don't believe that you should cut courses at urban schools just to make sure that we have four different foreign language courses. We'd like to have one, but it's just a point that we don't consider it an urban-rural issue. We don't consider it urban versus rural. We consider it a matter of looking at the uniqueness of the educational requirements in either or both places and assigning certain levels of importance to the solution. We are also, one of the things that we've done, and this came out of the original relationship between Senator Gorley and Portland Public Schools. We got together with the distance learning program in Portland Public Schools. They have a K-12 or a K-8 sequential elementary Spanish program that's just an excellent program called Ola Ola. And we worked it out with Portland Public Schools' distance learning program at that time and distributed Ola Ola on a taped basis to, at one time, almost 2,000 kids around the state, and now it's down to about 1,000. None of whom, quite frankly, are in our own area, which is kind of interesting. We provide Ola Ola on a tape basis to the Dallas School District, for instance, through the Frontier Earn Network. So we've looked at exporting services and outreach as much as we possibly can. We're in the process of drafting a memorandum of understanding with the Eastern Oregon Collaborative Colleges Council that will create greater expansion and enhancement of the programs that we have now that will reach almost throughout Eastern Oregon by the time we're done. And that's going to be what we feel is going to be a very beneficial relationship for remote rural students and actually all K-12 students for that matter throughout Eastern Oregon. And it's also a program that could be expanded to include statewide service. So that's essentially what it is. The connectivity was created not specifically for the Frontier Learning Network, but it certainly benefited the Frontier Learning Network. Gillum, Sherman, Wheeler counties and North Central ESD pooled their resources and built a 4,000 square mile telecommunications system. It's licensed wireless. It's 155 megabits. It's state of the art, and that's one of the things that we use to be able to provide for connectivity for the coursework throughout the Frontier Learning Network. So, if you have any questions, that's a very brief overview, and if you have any questions, I'd be certainly glad to answer them.
Senator Gorley and Senator Nelson asked for Mr. Meyer to come in, and Senator Nelson.
Well, thank you for coming in. Great program. We've talked on this committee about what would it take to expand statewide. And do this. You've done some of it. Sounds like you're providing some other services. I mean, it's such like a good program. How does this committee approach that issue? Well,
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson. The concept of creating a statewide network is fairly simple. It's the implementation that's the difficult part. However, it all comes back to connectivity, and we're certainly willing to work with the Department of Education in terms of how we accomplish that. We think it's a good idea. We think that that the idea behind the Frontier Learning Network always was to create a model that could be replicated elsewhere in the state or throughout the state. So the greater number of kids who can benefit from the experience that we've gained, and frankly it's been a considerable amount of experience that we've gained in doing this, would lend itself to being able to increase it to a statewide program. We're in the process also not only along with the collaboration with the Eastern Oregon Collaborative Colleges Council and the connectivity is always a part of this. If you're going to really look at distance learning, as you look at any type of program like that, you have to look at how do you create the connectivity for it to get there. And that's part of the key to the whole thing. The Frontier Learning Network, in concert with Frontier Telenet, which is another organization that involves Gillum, Sherman, Wheeler counties and the ESD, is a part of the Guardian Project, which will create connectivity between among the health centers all the way from St. Charles to St. Anthony's, St. Charles and Bend, St. Anthony's and Pendleton, and back to Mid-Columbia Medical Center and the Dallas and OHSU in Portland. So the Frontier Network is a part of that as well. But, Senator Nelson, it's an excellent question because it's just a matter, as much as anything else, of creating the connectivity. If you're going to have a virtual learning program, if you're going to create a virtual school district and a virtual distance learning program, the beauty of it is that it doesn't have to be centralized in Salem. It can be outsourced to places like you can put people on the ground in places like Condon, for instance. You could put them on the ground in Tillamook. You could put them on the ground in Roseburg. And there's no reason that those people have to reside and work from the centralized location of Salem. After all, it is a virtual program, so if you're really going to follow that concept to its logical conclusion, those people should be able to communicate and interact by video teleconferencing, and assuming you have the connectivity once again.
Just come up here. I think the department has a request for proposal out there for some sort of statewide thing. Do you know anything about that or any comments concerning that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Nelson, Vice Superintendent Fleming has mentioned that to me, and we haven't had a chance to talk about it in great detail, but I'm aware of something like that, yes.
It's the intent of the chair of the committee to actually spend some time during our deliberations here on the future of e-learning issues in the state. So both Frontier Network, the intent to look at the creating a virtual school, and just some of the underlying sort of difficulties that you might face in trying to do that. Difficulties in the sense of the number of different players that are involved.
Mr. Chair, I agree with you. Excuse me.
Hi, Mr. Myers. Nice to see you. Did you just spend the night?
I always do.
He was in my committee yesterday afternoon. Mr. Chair, the Education and Workforce Committee has a bill about virtual schools that we will be taking up on Wednesday.
Yeah.
And so I suspect that you may see some policy issue come down here. In
yeah. We're expecting several.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would just like to thank you for extending the invitation to Mr. Meyer, and thank you so much for coming and helping to help the committee better understand what is the Frontier Learning Network and what the opportunities are to expand options for more students in Oregon. And I really encourage the connection with the Department of Education, and I look forward to hearing that conversations are taking place, and I look forward to hearing what's being put in place to make those opportunities real for more students.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gordley, thank you very much. We're looking forward to the same kind of discourse, so we'll make something positive happen from it.
Thanks for your leadership.
Thank you very much, Mr. Meyer. Committee, tomorrow the Department of Ed will be back on the agenda. Mr. West will be doing his presentation. In the morning, we are going to we're going to try to follow a pattern that's basically determined in the morning. We may have some testimony coming in the morning on the ESL issue at 8:30, so we may go to that budget note first if those parties are here, and then we will go to the issue around SMART. Then we will go to West's testimony. Then we have asked someone to come in from SMART, and then we will actually close it off with some comments and any questions for the Department of Ed that you might have at this point, and then we will look forward to seeing them back in Phase 3.
We're picking them out, aren't we?
I think that's sometime in August now.
Optimist.
With that, we are. I'll close the hearing on 5509. Close the committee until tomorrow morning at 8:30.